Cassette 13, Side 2. Meanwhile, the world. He went back out on it again, rumpled land under the blue dome of the sky. The ordinary sky at the equator in spring changed color day by day. It took a color chart even to approximate the tone colors. Some days it was a deep violet blue, clematis blue, or hyacinth blue, or lapis lazuli, or a purplish indigo, or Prussian blue, a pigment made from ferric ferrocyanide. Interestingly, as there was certainly a lot of ferric material up there, iron blue, slightly more purple than Himalayan skies as seen in photographs, but otherwise like the Terran skies seen at those high altitudes, and combined with the rocky indented landscape, it did seem like a high altitude place. Everything, the sky color, the rumpled rock, the cold, thin air so pure and chill, everything so high. He walked into the wind, or across the wind, or with the wind at his back, and each felt different. In his nostrils, the wind was like a mild intoxicant flooding the brain. He stepped on lichen-crusted rocks from slab to slab, as if walking on a personal sidewalk appearing magically out of the shadow of the land, up and down, every step just a step, wandering attentive to the thisness of each moment, moment to moment to moment, each one discreet like bows loops of time-space, like the successive positions of a finch's head, the little birds plonking from one quantum pose to the next. It appeared on close inspection that moments were not regular units, but varied in duration, depending on what was happening in them. The wind dropped, no birds in sight, everything suddenly still and oh so silent except for the buzzing of insects. Those moments could last several seconds each, whereas when sparrows were dogfighting a crow, the moments were nearly instantaneous. Look very closely. Sometimes it was a flow, sometimes the plonk, plonk, plonk of individual stillnesses. To know. There were different ways of knowing, but none of them was quite so satisfactory, Sax decided, as the direct knowledge of the senses. Out here in the brilliant spring light and the cold wind, he came to the edge of a cliff and looked down onto the ultramarine plate of Seamud Fjord, silvered by myriad chips of light blazing off the water. Cliffs on the other side were banded by stratification lines, some of which had become green ledges lining the basalt. Gulls, puffins, terns, guillemots, osprey, all wheeling in the gulfs of air below him. As he learned the different fjords, he found he had his favorites. The Florentine, directly southeast of Da Vinci, was a pretty oval of water. A walk along the low bluffs overlooking it was continuously picturesque. Thick grass grew like a mat over these bluffs. They looked like Sax's image of the Irish coast. The land's edges were softening as soil and flora began to fill in the cracks, holding to mounds that defied the angle of repose, so that one walked over pads of ground, swelling between the sharp teeth of still bare rocks. Clouds poured inland from the sea to the north, and the rain fell, steady deluges that soaked everything. The day after a storm like that, the air steamed, the land gurgled and dripped, and every step off bare rock was a boggy squish. Heath, moor, bog. Gnarly little forests in the low grabens. A quick brown fox seen out of the corner of the eye as it dashed behind a Sierra juniper. Away from him, after something, no way to know. On business of its own. Waves striking the sea cliffs bounced back outward, creating interference patterns with the incoming waves that could have come right out of a physics wave tank, so beautiful and so strange that the world should conform so well to mathematical formulation. The unreasonable effectiveness of math. It was at the heart of the great unexplainable. Every sunset was different as a result of the residual fines in the upper atmosphere. These lofted so high that they were often illuminated by the sun long after everything else was in twilight's great shadow. So Sax would sit on the western sea cliff, rapt through the setting of the sun, then stay through the hour of twilight, watching the sky colors change as the sun's shadow rose up, until all the sky was black, and then sometimes there would appear noctilucent clouds 30 kilometers above the planet, broad streaks gleaming like abalone shells. The pewter sky of a hazy day, the florid sunset in a hard blow, the warmth of the sun on his skin at peace in a windless late afternoon, the patterns of waves on the sea below, the feel of the wind, the look of it. But once, in an indigo twilight, under the sparkling array of fat, blurry stars, he grew uneasy. "The snowy poles of moonless Mars," Tennyson had written just a few years before the discovery. Moonless Mars. It was in this hour that Phobos had used to shoot up over the western horizon like a flare. A moment of the Areophany, if ever there was one. Fear and dread. And he had completed the desatellization himself. They could have popped any military base built on Deimos. What had he been thinking? He couldn't remember. Some kind of desire for symmetry, down, up. But symmetry was perhaps a quality prized more by mathematicians than other people. Up. Somewhere Deimos was still orbiting the sun. He looked it up on the wrist. A lot of new colonies were starting out there. People were hollowing out asteroids, then spinning them to create a gravity effect on their insides, then moving in. New worlds. A word caught his eye. Pseudophobos. He tracked back, read. Informal name for an asteroid that somewhat resembled the lost moon in size and shape. Sax tapped around and got a photo. Well, the resemblance was superficial. A triaxial ellipsoid, but weren't they all? Potato-shaped, right size, banged hard on one end, a Stickney-esque crater. Stickney. There had been a nice little settlement tucked into it. What's in a name? Say they dropped the pseudo. A couple of mass drivers and AIs, some side jets. That peculiar moment when Phobos had shot up over the western horizon. Sax said. The days passed and the seasons. He did field studies and meteorology, effects of atmospheric pressure on cloud formation, meaning drives out around the peninsula, then a walk, then out with the balloons and kites. Weather balloons these days were elegant things, instrument packages less than 10 grams, lofted by a bag 8 meters tall, capable of rising right into the exosphere. Sax enjoyed arranging the bag over a smooth patch of sand or grass, the top downwind from him, then sitting and holding the delicate little payload in his fingers, then flicking the toggle that shot compressed hydrogen into the balloon and watching it fill and yank up at the sky. If he held on to the line, he was almost hauled to his feet, and without gloves on the line, would cut his palm, as he had quickly learned. Release it then, thump back to the sand, watch the round red dot shimmy up through the wind until it was a pinprick and then could no longer be seen. That happened at around 1,000 meters, depending on the haze in the air. Once it had happened as low as 479 meters. Once as high as 1,352 meters, a very clear day indeed. After that, he would read some of the data on his wrist, sitting in the sunshine, feeling like a little piece of him was sailing up into space. Strange what made one happy. The kites were just as nice. They were a bit more complex than the balloons, but a special pleasure during autumn when the trade winds blew strong and steady every day. Go out to one of the western sea cliffs, take a short run into the wind, get the kite into the air. A big orange box kite, bobbing this way and that. Then, as it got up into the steadier wind, it stabilized, and he reeled it out, feeling the shifts in the wind as subtle quiverings in his arms. Or else he wedged a spool pole in a crack and set the resistance and watched the kite soar up and away. The line was nearly invisible. When the spool ran out, the line hummed, and if he held it between his fingers, the wind's fluctuations were communicated to him as a kind of music. The kite would stay up for weeks at a time, out of sight or, if he kept it low enough, just within sight, a tiny flaw in the sky, transmitting data all the while. A square object was visible at a greater distance than a round object of the same area. The mind was a funny animal. Michel called up to talk about nothing in particular. This was the hardest kind of conversation of all for Sachs. The image of Michel would look down and to the right, and it would be very clear, as he spoke, that his mind was elsewhere, that he was unhappy, that Sachs needed to somehow take the lead. "Come visit and go for a walk with me," Sachs said again. "I really think you should." How could one emphasize that? "I really think you should." Throw things together. "Da Vinci is like the west coast of Ireland, the end of Europe, all green sea cliff over a big plate of water." Michel nodded uncertainly. Then a couple of weeks later, there he was, walking down a hall in Da Vinci. "I wouldn't mind seeing the end of Europe." "Good man." So they went out together on a day trip. Sachs drove him west to the Shalbatana Cliffs. Then they got out and walked north toward Simshal Point. Such a pleasure to have his old friend with him in this beautiful place. Seeing any of the first 100 was a welcome break in his routine, a rare event that he treasured. The weeks would pass in their comfortable round, and then suddenly one of the old family would appear, and it was like a homecoming without the home, making him think he perhaps ought to move to Sabishii or Odessa someday so that he could experience such a wonderful feeling more often. And no one's company pleased him more than Michel's. Although on this day Michel wandered behind, distracted, seemingly troubled. Sachs observed this and wondered what he could do to help. Michel had given him so much help in the long months of his return to speech, had taught him to think again, had taught him to see everything differently. It would be nice if he could do something to repay such a gift, even partially. Well, it would only happen if he said something. So after they stopped and Sachs got out the kite and assembled it, he handed the spool to Michel. "Here," he said. "I'll hold the kite ready. You run it up. That way, into the wind." And he held the kite as Michel walked across the grassy mounds until the line was taut and Sachs let the kite go as Michel started running and off it went, up, up, up. Michel came back grinning. "Here, touch the line. You can feel the wind." "Ah," Sachs said. "So you can." And the nearly invisible line thrummed against his fingers. They sat down and opened Sachs's wicker basket and took out the picnic lunch he had packed. Michel became quiet once again. "Something is troubling you," Sachs ventured as they ate. Michel waved a chunk of bread, swallowed. "I think I want to go back to Provence." "For good?" Sachs said, shocked. Michel frowned. "Not necessarily, but for a visit. I was only just beginning to enjoy my last visit there when we had to leave."
"It's heavy on Earth."
"True, but I found the adjustment surprisingly easy." Sachs hadn't liked the return to Terran gravity. Certainly, evolution had adapted their bodies to it, and it was true that living in 0.38G caused an array of medical problems. But he was used to the feel of Martian G now, to the point he never noticed it. And if he did, it felt good.
"Without Maya?" he said.
"I suppose it would have to be. She doesn't want to go. She says she will someday, but it's always later, later. She's working for the credit co-op bank in Sabashii and thinks she's indispensable. Well, that's not fair. She just doesn't want to miss any of it."
"Can you not make a kind of Provence where you live? Plant an olive grove?"
"It's not the same."
"No, but..."
Sachs didn't know what to say.
He felt no nostalgia for Earth. As for living with Maya, he could no more imagine that than he could imagine living in a damaged, erratic centrifuge. The effect would be much the same. Thus, perhaps Michelle's desire for solid ground, for the touch of the earth. "You should go," Sack said, "but wait just a little longer. If they get these pulsed fusion engines on spaceships, then you could be there fairly soon. But that might cause real problems with Earth's gravity. I think you need the months of the trip to get prepared for it." Sax nodded. "What you would need is a kind of exoskeleton. Inside, you'd feel somewhat supported, and therefore as if in a lighter G, perhaps. Those new bird suits I've heard of, they must have the capacity to stiffen to something like an exoskeleton, or you'd never be able to hold the wings in position." "An ever-shifting carapace of carbon," Michelle said with a smile. "A flowing shell." "Yes. You might be able to wear something like that to walk around in. It wouldn't be so bad." "So first we move to Mars, you're saying, where we have to wear walkers for 100 years. Then when we have changed everything to the extent that we can sit out here in the sun only slightly freezing, then we move back to Earth, where we have to wear walkers again for another 100 years.
"Or forever after," Sack said.
"That's correct." Michelle laughed.
"Well, maybe I will go then, when it gets like that."
He shook his head. "Someday we'll be able to do everything we want, eh?" The sun beat down on them. The wind rustled over the tips of the grass, each blade a green stroke of light. Michelle talked about Maya for a while, first complaining, then making allowances, then enumerating her good qualities, the qualities that made her indispensable, the source of all excitement in life. Sax nodded dutifully at every declaration, no matter how much they contradicted the ones that had come before. It was like listening to an addict, he imagined. But this was the way people were, and he wasn't so far from such contradictions himself. After a silence had stretched out, Sax said, "How do you think Anne sees this kind of landscape now?" Michelle shrugged. "I don't know. I haven't seen her for years." "She didn't take the brain plasticity treatment." "No, she's stubborn, eh? She wants to stay herself. But in this world, I'm afraid..." Sax nodded. "If you saw all the signs of life in the landscape as contaminations, as a horrible mold encrusting the pure beauty of the mineral world, then even the oxygen blue of the sky would be implicated. It would drive one mad. Even Michelle thought so. I'm afraid she will never be sane. Not really."
"I know."
On the other hand, who were they to say? Was Michelle insane because he was obsessively concerned with a region on another planet or in love with a very difficult person? Was Sax insane because he could no longer speak well and had trouble with various mental operations as the result of a stroke and an experimental cure? He didn't think so in either case. But he did believe quite firmly that he had been rescued from a storm by Hiroko, no matter what Desmond said. This, some might consider a sign of, well, of purely mental events seeming to have an external reality, which was often cited as a symptom of insanity, as Sax recalled.
"Like those people who think they've seen Hiroko," he murmured tentatively to see what Michelle would say.
"Ah, yes," Michelle said. "Magical thinking. It's a very persistent form of thinking. Never let your rationalism blind you to the fact that most of our thinking is magical thinking. And so often following archetypal patterns, as in Hiroko's case, which is like the story of Persephone or Christ. I suppose that when someone like that dies, the shock of the loss is nearly insupportable, and then it only takes one grieving friend or disciple to dream of the lost one's presence and wake up crying, 'I saw her,' and within a week everyone is convinced that the prophet is back or never died at all. And thus with Hiroko, who's spotted regularly."
"But I really did see her," Sax wanted to say. She grabbed my wrist. And yet he was deeply troubled. Michelle's explanation made good sense, and it matched up very well with Desmond's. Both these men missed Hiroko greatly, Sachs presumed, and yet they were facing up to the fact of her disappearance and its most probable explanation. And unusual mental events might very understandably occur in the stress of a physical crisis. Maybe he had hallucinated her, but no, that wasn't right. He could remember it just as it had happened, every detail vivid. But it was a fragment, he noticed, as when one recalled a fragment of a dream upon waking, everything else slipping out of reach with an almost tangible squirt, like something slick and elusive. He couldn't quite remember, for instance, what had come right before Hiroko's appearance, or after. Not the details. He clicked his teeth together nervously. There were all kinds of madness, evidently. Anne wandering the old world, off on her own. The rest of them staggering on in the new world like ghosts, struggling to construct one life for another. Maybe it was true what Michelle said, that they couldn't come to grips with their longevity, that they didn't know what to do with their time, didn't know how to construct a life. Well, still, here they were, sitting on the Da Vinci sea cliffs. There was no need to get too overwrought about these matters. Not really. As Nanao would have said, what now is lacking? They had eaten a good lunch, were full, not thirsty, out in the sun and wind, watching a kite soar far above in a dark velvet blue, old friends sitting in the grass, talking. What now was lacking? Peace of mind? Nanao would have laughed. The presence of other old friends? Well, there would be other days for that. Now, in this moment, they were two old brothers in arms, sitting on a sea cliff. After all the years of struggle, they could sit out there all afternoon, if they liked, flying a kite and talking, discussing their old friends and the weather. There had been trouble before. There would be trouble again. But here they were. How John would have liked this, Sack said haltingly. So hard to speak of these things. I wonder if he could have made Anne see it. How I miss him. How I want her to see it. Not to see it the way I do, just to see it as if it were something good. See how beautiful it is in its own way, in itself, the way it all organizes itself. We say we manage it, but we don't. It's too complex. We just brought it here. After that, it took off on its own. Now we try to push it this way or that. But the total biosphere, it's self-organizing. There's nothing unnatural about it. Well, Michelle demurred, there isn't. We can fiddle all we want, but we're only like the sorcerer's apprentice. It's all taken on a life of its own. But the life it had before, Michelle said, this is what Anne treasures. The life of the rocks and the ice. Life? Some kind of slow mineral existence. Call it what you will, an areophany of rock. Besides, who's to say that these rocks don't have their own kind of slow consciousness? I think consciousness has to do with brains, Sack said primly. Perhaps, but who can say? And if not consciousness as we define it, then at least existence, an intrinsic worth simply because it exists. That's a worth it still has. Sack picked up a rock the size of a baseball, brecciated ejecta from the looks of it, a shatter cone, common as dirt. Actually much more common than dirt. He inspected it closely. Hello, rock. What are you thinking? I mean, here it all is,
still here.
But not the same.
But nothing is ever the same. Moment to moment, everything changes. As for mineral consciousness, that's too mystical for me. Not that I'm automatically opposed to mysticism, but still... Michel laughed.
You've changed a lot, Sax, but you are still Sax.
I should hope so, but I don't think Anne is much of a mystic either.
What then?
I don't know. I don't know. Such a pure scientist that she can't stand to have the data contaminated? That's a silly way to put it. An awe at the phenomena. Do you know what I mean by that? Worship of what is. Live with it and worship it, but don't try to change it and mess it up, wreck it. I don't know, but I want to know.
You always want to know.
True. But this I want to know more than most things. More than anything else I can think of, truly.
Ah, Sax, I want Provence. You want Anne.
Michel grinned. We're both crazy. They laughed. Photons rained onto their skin, most shooting right through them. Here they were, transparent to the world.
Part 10. Wärtersvandel. It was past midnight. The offices were quiet. The head advisor went to the samovar and started dispensing coffee into tiny cups. Three of his colleagues stood around a table covered with hand screens. From the samovar, the head advisor said, "So spheres of deuterium and helium-3 are struck by your laser array one after the next. They implode and fusion takes place. Temperature at ignition is 700 million kelvins, but this is okay because it's a local temperature and very short-lived. A matter of nanoseconds. Good. I find that comforting. Then, okay, the resulting energy is released entirely as charged particles so that they can all be contained by your electromagnetic fields. There are no neutrons to fly forward and fry your passengers. The fields serve as shield and pusher plate, and also as the collection system for the energy used to fuel the lasers. All the charged particles are directed out the back, passing through your angled mirror apparatus, which is the door arc for the lasers, and the passage collimates the fusion products."
"That's right. That's the neat part," said the engineer.
"Very neat. How much fuel does it burn?"
"If you want Mars gravity equivalent acceleration, that's 3.73 meters per second squared. So assume a ship of 1,000 tons, 350 tons for the people in the ship, and 650 for the device and fuel, then you have to burn 373 grams a second.
Ka, that adds up fairly fast. It's about 30 tons a day, but it's a lot of acceleration, too. The trips are short."
"And these spheres are how big?"
The physicist said. "A centimeter radius, mass 0.29 grams. So we burn 1,290 of them per second. That ought to give passengers in the ship a good continuous G-feel."
"I should say so. But helium-3, isn't it quite rare?"
The engineer said.
"A Galilean collective has started harvesting it out of the upper atmosphere of Jupiter, and they may be working out that surface collection method on Luna as well, though it's not been going well. But Jupiter has all we'll ever need."
"So the ships will carry 500 passengers?"
"That's what we've been using for our calculations. It could be adjusted, of course."
"You accelerate halfway to your destination, turn around and decelerate for the second half of the trip."
The physicist shook his head.
"Short trips, yes. Longer trips, no. You only need to accelerate for a few days to be going quite fast. Longer trips, you should coast through the middle to save fuel. The head advisor nodded, handed the others full cups. They sipped. The mathematician said,
"Travel times will change so radically. 3 weeks from Mars to Uranus, 10 days from Mars to Jupiter. From Mars to Earth, 3 days. 3 days!"
She looked around at the others, frowning.
"It will make the solar system something like Europe in the 19th century. Train trips, ocean liners."
The others nodded. The engineer said,
"Now we're neighbors with people on Mercury, or Uranus, or Pluto."
The head advisor shrugged.
"Or for that matter, Alpha Centauri.
Let's not worry about that. Contact is a good thing. Only connect, the poet says. Only connect. Now we will connect with a vengeance." He raised his cup.
Cheers.
Nergal got in a rhythm and kept it all day. Lungompa. The religion of running. Running as meditation or prayer. Zazen. Ka. Zen. Part of the Areophany, as Martian gravity was integral to it. What the human body could achieve in 2/5 the pull it had evolved for was a euphoria of effort. One ran as a pilgrim, half worshipper, half god. A religion with quite a few adherents these days, loners out running around. Sometimes there were organized runs, races, Thread the Labyrinth, Chaos Crawl, the Transmarineris, the Round the Worlder, and in between those, the daily discipline. Purposeless activity, art for art's sake. For Nergal, it was worship, or meditation, or oblivion. His mind wandered, or focused on his body, or on the trail, or went blank. At this moment, he was running to music, Bach, then Bruckner, then Bonnie Tyndall, an Elysian neoclassicist whose music poured along like the day itself, tall chords shifting in steady internal modulation, somewhat like Bach or Bruckner, in fact, but slower and steadier, more inexorable and grand. Fine music to run by, even though for hours at a time he didn't consciously hear it. He only ran. It was coming time for the Round the Worlder, which began every other perihelion. Starting from Sheffield, the contestants could run east or west around the world without wrist pad or any other navigational aid, shorn of everything but the information of their senses and small bags of food and drink and gear. They were allowed to choose any route that stayed within 20 degrees of the equator. They were tracked by satellite and disqualified if they left the equatorial zone. And all bridges were allowed, including the Ganges Strait Bridge, which made routes both north and south of Marineris competitive and created almost as many viable routes as contestants. Nergal had won the race in 5 of the 9 previous runnings because of his route-finding ability rather than his speed. The Nergalvak was considered by many runners to be in the nature of a mystical achievement, full of counterintuitive extravagance, and in the last couple races he had had trackers following him with the plan of passing him at the end. But each year he took a different route, and often he made choices that looked so bad that some of his trackers gave up and took off in more promising directions. Others couldn't keep up the pace over the 200 days of the circumnavigation, crossing some 21,000 kilometers. It required truly long-distance endurance. One had to be able to sustain it as a way of life. Running every day. Nergal liked it. He wanted to win the next Round the Worlder, to have won a majority of the first 10. He was out researching the route, checking new trails. Many new paths were being built every year. There had been a craze recently to inlay staircase trails in the sides of the canyon cliffs and dorsa and escarpments that everywhere seamed the outback. The trail he was on now had been constructed since he had last been in this area. It dropped down the steep cliff wall of a sink in the Aramadum Chaos, and there was a matching trail on the opposite wall of the sink.
Going straight through Aramadum would add a fair bit of verticality to a run, but all flatter routes had to swing far to north or south, and Nergal thought that if all the trails were as good as this one, the cost in elevation might turn out to be worth it. The new trail occupied angled cracks in the blocky cliff wall, the steps fitted like the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, and very regular, so that it was like running down a staircase in the ruined wall of some giant's castle. Cliffside trail-making was an art, a lovely form of work that Nergal had joined from time to time, helping to move cut rocks from a crane to wedge them into position on top of the step below. Hours in a belay harness, pulling on the thin green lines with gloved hands, guiding big polygons of basalt into place. The first trail builder Nergal had met had been a woman constructing a trail along the finback of the Geryon Montes, the long ridge on the floor of Ayas Kazma. He had helped her all of one summer down most of the ridge. She was still in Marinara somewhere, constructing trails with her hand tools and high-powered rock saws and pulley systems with a super-strong line and glue bolts stronger than the rock itself, painstakingly assembling a sidewalk or staircase from the surrounding rock, some trails like miraculously helpful natural features, others like Roman roads, others still with a pharaonic or Incan massiveness, huge blocks fitted with hairline precision across boulder slopes or large-grained chaos. Down 300 steps, counting, then across the sink floor in the hour before sunset, the strip of sky a velvet violet glowing over dark cliff walls. No trail here on the shadowed sand of the sink floor, and he focused on the rocks and plants scattered over it, running between things, his glance caught by light-colored flowers on top of round-barreled cacti, glowing like the sky. His body was also glowing with the end of the day's run and the prospect of dinner, his hunger a gnawing from within, a faintness getting more unpleasant by the minute. He found the staircase trail on the western cliff wall, up and up, changing gears into the uphill push stride, smooth and regular, turning left and right with the switchbacks, admiring the elegant placement of the trail in the crack system of the cliff, a placement that usually had him running with a waist-high wall of rock on the air side, except during the ascent of one bare, sheer patch of rock where the builders had been forced to the extremity of bolting in a solid magnesium ladder. He hurried up it, feeling his quadriceps like giant rubber bands. He was tired. On a plinth to the left of the staircase, there was a flat patch with a great view of the long, narrow canyon below. He turned off the trail and stopped running. He sat down on a rock like a chair. It was windy. He popped his little mushroom tent, and it stood before him transparent in the dusk. Bedding, lamp, lectern, all pulled hastily from his fanny pack in the search for food, all burnished by years of use and as light as feathers. His gear kit altogether weighed less than 3 kilos, and there they were in their place at the back, battery-powered stove and food bag and water bottle. The twilight passed in Himalayan majesty as he cooked a pot of powdered soup, sitting cross-legged on his sleeping pad, leaning back against the tent's clear wall, tired muscles feeling the luxury of sitting down. Another beautiful day. He slept poorly that night and got up in the pre-dawn cold wind and packed up quickly, shivering, and ran west again. Out of the last Aramadum jumbles, he came to the northern shore of Ganges Bay. The dark blue plate of the bay lay to his left as he ran. Here the long beaches were backed by wide sand dunes, covered by short grass that made for easy running. Nergal flowed on in his rhythm, glancing at the sea or into the taiga forest off to the right. Millions of trees had been planted along this coastline in order to stabilize the ground and cut down on dust storms. The great forest of Ophir was one of the least populated regions on Mars. It had been rarely visited in the earlier years of its existence and had never been host to a tent town. Deep deposits of dust and fines had discouraged travel. Now these deposits were somewhat fixed by the forest, but bordering the streams were swamps and quicksand lakes and unstable less bluffs that caused breaks in the lattice roof of branches and leaves. Nergal kept to the border of forest and sea, on the dunes or among stands of smaller trees. He crossed several small bridges spanning river mouths. He spent a night on the beach, lulled to sleep by the sound of breaking waves. The next day at dawn, he followed the trail under the canopy of green leaves, the coast having stopped at the Ganges Chasma Dam. The light was dim and cool. Everything at this hour looked like a shadow of itself. Faint trails branched off uphill to the left. The forest here was conifer for the most part, redwoods in tall groves surrounded by smaller pines and junipers. The forest floor was covered by dry needles. In wet places, ferns broke through this brown mat, adding their archaic fractals to the sun-dappled floor. A stream braided among narrow grassy islands. He could rarely see more than 100 meters ahead. Green and brown were the dominant colors. The only red visible was the tint of the redwood's hairy bark. Shafts of sunlight, like slender living beings, danced over the forest floor. Nergal ran outside himself, mesmerized as he passed among these pencils of light. He skipped on rocks across a shallow creek in a fern-floored glade. It was like crossing a room, with hallways extending to similar rooms upstream and down. A short waterfall gurgled to his left.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 13 of Blue Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading Cassette 14.